give a damn.
The stuff that dreams are made of.
I love the smell of napalm in the morning.
Go ahead. Make my day.
You talking to me? You talking to me?
Welcome to Hollywood Babble, episode 8. This is the podcast for film lovers, movie buffs, cineasts, cinephiles, film freaks, movie maniacs, picture goers, movie junkies, film addicts, and popcorn munchers. So far, the history of cinema has shown us a group of like-minded individuals building on the innovations of those that came before them. Edison Manufacturing contributed a corporate structure, a research and development lab that incubated motion pictures. The Lumières had more of a mom-and-pop shop, fathers and sons, trusted colleagues that traveled the world introducing the device and recording local scenes. The Lumières even refused to sell their camera to people that just didn't fit into their profile or have enough prestige. It was not a very capitalistic approach. Edison, on the other hand, unloaded his kinetoscopes and vitascopes to whoever could clear the check. Meanwhile, in Great Britain, the Brighton School saw budding filmmakers supporting, encouraging, and competing with each other. In each of these situations, we see alliances, groups working towards a common cause. In this episode, we're going to concentrate on one singular individual that stands apart from the rest. Bienvenue, Georges Méliès, le magicien du cinéma. This is Hollywood Babble. I'm Jeremy. Thanks for listening. Méliès was the cinema's first true artist, a stylish innovator who recognized the potential of new media. While the Lumière shot slice-of-life actualities, trains arriving, workers leaving factories, babies eating, and Edison staged boxing bouts, dramatic dances, and sensational kisses, Méliès told fantastic stories. He took viewers to the moon, to the bottom of the ocean. He introduced silly Satans, men with inflatable heads, and replicating musicians. Photographers since E.J. Marais and Edward Muybridge had tried to capture reality, but Méliès was on a very different mission. He was looking to capture fantasy. In addition to using his movies for a very different purpose, developing dramatic narratives and eye-popping spectacles, Méliès also developed a new vocabulary to tell these stories. And his new cinema grammar included fade-ins and fade-outs, dissolves and jump cuts, and stop-motion effects. Méliès presented his imaginary worlds in otherworldly colors with meticulously hand-tinted frames. His movies shimmered with color. But this artisan aspect could never coexist in a film industry that craved ever more content with faster turnarounds and replicated formulaic successes. Even without deep knowledge of film history, you might recognize Méliès' movies. His most famous works are part of our shared media memory. Méliès created a realm of fun fantasy, and he demonstrated the potential of motion pictures to conjure fictional worlds. So let's get to it. The Méliès family owned a shoe factory. Georges was in line to run the plant with his brother, Gaston. But young Georges liked the Parisian nightlife better. In the 1880s, he began hanging out at local magic clubs. He was fascinated by the illusions, the tricks, the magic lantern shows. In 1888, he purchased the Theatre Robert Houdin. It was the perfect setup for the 27-year-old aspiring magician. Monsieur Méliès, le père, his dad, was a practical man, and this was unlikely to have made him happy. Who was going to mind the shop? But before long, Georges had become a respected maher in the Parisian entertainment world. Maybe that's why he received an invite to the Lumière's premiere show at the Grand Café on December 28, 1895. That afternoon changed Georges Méliès' life. Méliès was fascinated by the cinematograph. Wouldn't it be the perfect attraction for his theater? Wouldn't it be the sine qua non of magic? cinematograph machines had been sold to the Sultan Abd al-Aziz of Morocco, Inabata Katsutora of Japan, and Mozavar al-Din Shah of Iran. Méliès tried to buy one, but the Lumières rejected his request. They wouldn't sell their device to a stage performer like Méliès. So Méliès reached out to Robert Paul in Great Britain and acquired one of the Brits' pirated products, the Theatrograph. And this is how the movies became the new gimmick at the Theatre Robert Houdin. Méliès projected Edison shorts and Paul produced films, but it wasn't long before he made his own content. In May 1896, Méliès released Une Partie de Cards, playing cards. It was a remake of the Lumière's Monsieur Lumière at Cards. Not thrilling, but it was a start. By the end of 1896, Méliès was in the film biz with both feet. He produced almost 100 films that first year and began trademarking his pictures with the Star Film Company logo. In 1897, he constructed a studio in the Paris suburb of Montreuil. Here, Méliès made movies, created special effects, and built a glass-roofed studio, which would become the model for European studios of the silent era. The Montreuil setup allowed Méliès to make elaborate, meticulously detailed pictures. Now, there's a story about how he discovered motion pictures' ability to manipulate reality. Likely, it's apocryphal and untrue, but this is what Méliès claimed. He said that one day, while he was filming at La Place d'Opera, his camera jammed. And he developed the film, and lo and behold, he was thrilled to find that a passing bus had jump-cutted into becoming a hearse. The jam in the camera altered reality. Méliès replicated this in-camera edit to make his beautiful assistant disappear in L'Escumetage d'une Dame chez Robert Houdin, The Vanishing Lady, in 1896. On film, the trick was far more convincing than anything he could do live on stage. She really did disappear in the movie. Now, I don't believe the story about the hearse. It's too perfect. It's too dramatic. But what is important here is that while other early filmmakers were capturing reality, Méliès realized the value in changing it, manipulating the image for drama. The movies that Méliès made are the earliest films to survive as total, coherent artistic creations with their own personality and distinctive visual style. In 1896, he began producing actualities, jumping on the early film bandwagon with greatest hits like Street Scenes, Trains Arriving, Blacksmith Smithing, Children Playing, and Serpentine Dances. These were favorite subjects of early filmmakers. But by the end of that first year, Méliès was already beginning to get creative. The Haunted Castle, or the Devil's Castle, in 1896, used stop-motion effects, extravagant painted sets, and elaborate costumes. He produced a risque striptease film, Après les Bals, in 1897. Here, a woman undresses, and with her back to the camera, we see her bare butt as an assistant or maid pours water over her body. This was hot stuff. The Dreyfus Affair in 1899 was a series of films, 13 minutes altogether, that focused on controversial political content, the Dreyfus case, which was a headliner just 4 years earlier. Joan of Arc in 1900 was 19 minutes long and featured shimmering colors. And Méliès was perfect as his own leading man in wonderful trick films like One Man Band from 1900. Here he multiplied himself playing different instruments, appearing on stage playing a violin, a trombone, a drum, and conducting all simultaneously and then re-merging into one Méliès and disappearing in a puff of smoke. In Man with the India Rubber Head from 1901, a well-placed close-up made it seem like Méliès's head was expanding like a bubble. Here's an interesting one, the coronation of King Edward VII from 1902. This film was ordered by Charles Urban at Warwick Trading and produced by Melies and G.A. Smith in collaboration. They couldn't get the rights to the actual event. An American production company, Biograph, had the exclusive. So Melies and Smith created a simulation of King Edward's crowning a week before the ceremony in June 1902. Then, suddenly, Edward was stricken with appendicitis, and the picture had to be yanked from circulation. Can't have an actuality of an event that didn't actually happen. Well, the king was okay. He healed, and the coronation was rescheduled. Studio boss Charles Urban then dispatched cameramen to the real-life event and mixed documentary shots with the Melies-Smith film. Interestingly, because Edward was still recovering, his mobility was limited, so there were shots in the film, like him kneeling to be crowned, that didn't even occur at the event. Does this count as fake news? 2 months after the imitation coronation of Edward VII was released, Melies' big hit was finished, A Trip to the Moon, 1902. You'll know this one, and we'll come back here in just a second. In 1903, Melies made Kingdom of the Fairies and The Infernal Cakewalk, with underwater shots, a silly papier-mâché whale, fiery underworld scenes, and a funny demon. In The Impossible Voyage, 1904, here we have an ancestor to the Hogwarts Express, a train that leaps off the tracks and into the sky. But Melies one-ups even Harry Potter. His train goes further and off into space. It passes the man in the sun, similar to the man in the moon in A Trip to the Moon. Impossible Voyage is also filled with wonderful spacecrafts and submarines. Sure, they are cardboard and theatrical, unreal, but they're so very creative. The Palace of the Arabian Nights from 1905 teems with ornate Orientalism. This one was a perfect melding of style and content. Also, the colors here are just otherworldly. A barge of women floats by and a rotund sultan stumbles out. Conquest of the Pole in 1912 was Melies' very last film and a magnum opus of sorts. There's a squadron of fanciful aircrafts, but the centerpiece is a ferocious ice giant. It's theatrical and stagey, but so memorable and so much fun. Melies' cinema vision is unique, imaginative, wonderfully detailed, and elaborate, intricate. But take a look at his style for a minute. This is less advanced. Every shot is a separate, self-contained tableau. There's no connective tissue. There's no pacing within a scene. It's like watching a stage play or magic act vignettes. The camera never moves. Melies' creative vision was boundless, but his style was limited, even primitive. Let's take a look at Monsieur Melies' most famous, most influential, and most memorable film, A Trip to the Moon. We open at a meeting of the Astronomers Club. Next, we see our boys building a space capsule in the shape of a bullet. Here come the chorus girls, heavyset girls in hot pants. They cheer as the capsule is loaded into a cannon. Fired, and now here comes the money shot, the image that will be familiar to all. The space capsule hits the man in the moon right in the eye. Next, we have a little chronological glitch. The ship lands again, this time safely on the lunar surface. We'll come back to this, but note the overlay in the chronological continuity. A comet passes, the Big Dipper, Saturn, a moon goddess. It seems nice. And then, alien attack. Luckily, these aliens explode in a puff of smoke as soon as they're smacked with an umbrella. The astronomers are captured, they escape, they run back to their capsule, push it over a cliff, and send it careening back to Earth, with one alien attached. The spaceship plunges into the ocean. Towed ashore, the chorus girls cheer, there's a parade for our boys. The end. A Trip to the Moon is so creative. It's so much fun. Early audiences must have been amused. I mean, we're still tickled today. But here's one thing that we might not see today that original audiences may have understood better, and that is the film has an underlying political message. Remember that Méliès made the Dreyfus Affair 2 years earlier. The message in The Moon is anti-colonial. A trip to the moon mocks imperialism, presenting Earth conquerors as bumbling idiots who attack the moon men without cause. Like African explorers, they return with a mistreated captive to the fanfare of self-congratulation. Stylistically, once again in The Moon, we see it is entirely composed of self-contained tableaus, a series of set pieces. Each scene is distinct, discrete, unconnected, a self-contained unit. There are no shots, there's just scenes. Hollywood-style continuity editing hadn't yet developed. We'll see the seeds of that the following year in The Great Train Robbery in 1903. Also, in A Trip to the Moon, time and space are flexible. This allows Méliès to repeat key moments. Remember that rocket ship that landed twice? Replay the moment for emphasis, for showmanship. This is not the realistic cause and effect linear time that we experience in real life. Now, if you saw Trip to the Moon at the Theatre Robert Houdin, you would also get a special treat. Méliès himself might be playing piano to accompany the picture, and an eye-popping, candy-colored movie would leap off the screen. Thanks to the mother-daughter team of Elisabeth and Bert Thuyer, who provided meticulous hand coloring. We'll return to these female film artisans in episode 15, but for now, let's just mention that the Thuyers colored Méliès films from 1897 on, picking up other notable clients including Seelig and Pathé. Méliès also produced black and white versions of his pictures to sell and distribute. So Moon pulled out all the stops. It used the full bag of tricks that the filmmaker had learned or invented. Multiple exposures, dissolves, jump cuts, elaborate costumes, mechanically operated scenery. And it was worth it. Méliès' Moon attracted worldwide fans and became one of the most popular films of the early 20th century, if not the very most popular. But it also attracted plagiarism, infringement, and theft. Dupes, copied versions of the film spread. By 1904, Lubin, Seelig, and Edison Manufacturing were all distributing unauthorized copies of A Trip to the Moon, often not even crediting Méliès. In order to counter the problem of piracy, Méliès opened an American branch of the Star Film Company, managed by his brother Gaston. A few years later, by 1905, the Motion Picture Patents Company was forming, so, with fellow French production company Pathé, Méliès was invited in. They joined with the top U.S. filmmakers, Edison, Biograph, Vitagraph, SNA, Seelig, Polyscope, Lubin, and Kalem. These guys formed a cartel, a trust to freeze out independent competition. We'll get to that in episode 12. But while Pathé, Edison, Biograph, and Vitagraph were corporate giants, Méliès' handmade pictures were not set up for this structure. In 1908, the MPPC standardized prices, and this hurt Méliès. Unlike the churn at the big production companies, Méliès' projects were labor-intensive and impractically expensive under the new standard. Also, by 1908, realism was in, with chase films, robberies, comedies, and drama. D.W. Griffith had begun leaving his mark, and fanciful fairy films had fallen out of vogue. As Star Films suffered and the MPPC became bogged down in legal actions around 1910, Gaston got out of Dodge. In 1911, he left the East Coast and opened a studio in San Antonio, Texas. Next, he was working in Santa Paula, California, not far from Oxnard, Ventura. Gaston continued westward, leaving for French Polynesia, New Zealand, Tahiti, Singapore, and Japan. Along the way, he sent back exotic films. Gaston's travelogue movies revealed a far different world than the one manufactured by his brother in Montreuil. Gaston's career is fascinating and understudied. I devote some time to him in my book, Film Censorship in America, available on Amazon.com. And I hope that we can return to Gaston Méliès in this podcast down the road a piece. But for now, let's go back to George. Moon was a fan favorite, sure, but for Méliès personally, it was not even his proudest achievement. In 1908, Georges Méliès made Humanity Through the Ages, a historical drama that condemned brutality and intolerance. Once again, it was still presented in tableau-like scenes. Méliès detailed Cain and Abel, Roman Emperor Nero and the persecution of the Christians, then through the Middle Ages and up to the Hague Convention of 1907. The Hague scene ends with the convention collapsing into chaos. The delegates who had convened with the intention of limiting military action in Europe end up attacking each other. This disorganization would ultimately set the stage for World War I. Méliès was versatile. He could make escapist fantasies, from a trip to the moon to a conquest of the pole, and scathing political commentaries from the Dreyfus Affair to Humanity Through the Ages. In 1909, he was invited to the European International Congress of Filmmakers. This gathering had Europe's foremost filmmakers, Pathé, Gaumont, Eclair of France, Sinés and Ambrosio of Italy, Hepworth from Britain, Nordisk from Denmark, Mester of Germany, and Georges Méliès was elected chairman. This meeting sat on the cusp of a new era. An industry was emerging that had little place for an independent cine artist like Méliès. Of course, he didn't know this yet. Motion picture making was standardizing into an industrial mode of production that churned out content in order to feed an ever-expanding audience of film fans hungry for the newest, latest, coolest film. And our friend George was being left behind by this evolving industrial corporate standardized structure. Méliès's static camera and theatrical content were out of place as mavericks like D.W. Griffith, Max Sennett, Ernst Lubitsch, and Eric von Stroheim were on the horizon. In 1910, Méliès signed with Pathé and was folded into the French film giant. His independence was gone, and within 2 years, his film career was over. Méliès left Pathé in 1912. 2 years after that, during World War I, Theatre Robert Houdin was shuttered and later torn down. Méliès's handmade art films could not exist in the new film industry. His fanciful visions were out of place in a war-torn world. George suffered. He was forced to sell his glass-roofed studio, already in ruins from World War I. He liquidated all of his scenery, props, costumes, and with nowhere to store his films, Méliès ordered the destruction of all of his negatives. Perhaps they burned by themselves, since the nitrate film stock was so highly flammable, especially with all the tints and color dyes that he used. I've also read that the French government stripped the film of its emulsion to make heels for shoes. The point is, the magic was gone. Now impoverished, Méliès married his former on-screen star, Juhan Delcy. Juhan had appeared in House of the Devil in 1896, which was probably the first horror film. She played Joan in Joan of Arc in 1899, Cleopatra in Cleopatra. She stripped down in Après les Bals, that sexy, risque film, and she was a literal star in A Trip to the Moon. But those days were done. World War I blew Méliès' fun fantasy world into oblivion. And by the 1910s, he was reduced to selling toys, novelties, and candy from a boutique in Montparnasse train station. A Trip to the Moon was a relic. Its visionary, a forgotten man. But wait, The story doesn't end there. In 1924, a French film student named Georges-Michel Cossiac was working on a book, an histoire of early film, entitled The History of Film from Its Origin to the Present Day. Cossiac rediscovered Méliès, literally. He found him in the train station. Cossiac's book was published in 1925, and by 1929, Georges Méliès had become a cause célèbre. A retrospective was held. He was rescued from squalor and obscurity and provided modest accommodations with Juhan at a film industry retirement home in Orly, a southern suburb of Paris. In 1931, Méliès was awarded the Legion of Honor. Still, his New York Times obit on January 23, 1938, was just one single paragraph long. Georges Méliès, a pioneer motion picture producer, died yesterday at a Paris hospital after a long illness. His age was 77. Mr. Méliès began producing in 1895. He presided over the first International Congress of the Cinema. That's it. No magic. There was no sign of moon men, devils, near-naked ladies, fantastic folktales, or magic tricks. No mention of Méliès manufactured worlds of wonder, realms of pure imagination. For those who didn't know Méliès, his presence was not missed. They never knew that the Technicolor visions in The Wizard of Oz owed so much to the magician from Montreuil. But wait, it's still not over. Méliès was discovered yet again, nearly a century after he had released his last film, in Brian Selznick's awesome, wordless epic book, The Invention of Hugo Cabret. In the book, Hugo is an orphan scavenging in the Montparnasse train station. His adversary is a grumpy shopkeeper. Young Hugo discovers an automaton once used in magic shows, and this device becomes the link between Hugo, his dead father, and yes, Georges Méliès. Of course, that grumpy shopkeeper was the film visionary. Martin Scorsese, a director deeply informed by the history of cinema, made a movie that gave Georges Méliès his proper due. Perfectly played by Ben Kingsley, Scorsese's Hugo in 2011 brought the filmmaker back to life, reconstructed that incredible glass studio, and resurrected Méliès's amazing films with 21st century technology. One would think Méliès would have smiled. It had been a long wait, 116 years between Méliès's first film and the release of Hugo. But you know, I think it might have been worth it. It was a love song to the creative power of the cinema. This is Hollywood Babble. Thanks for listening. Let's end the episode with a line from my favorite movie buff, my son Jackson.
Surely you can't be serious.
I am serious, and don't call me Shirley.
Do you know the film? Visit us on Twitter at Hollywood Babble for the film title, and also tell us your thoughts, comments, suggestions, etc. Here it comes one more time.
Surely you can't be serious.
I am serious, and don't call me Shirley.
For the right answer, Hollywood Babble on Twitter. This episode goes out to James Walker, Will Graziano, Jeff Hopkins, and the 6 a.m. crew at High Voltage. You guys keep me sane. Thanks for everything. Everyone else, I hope to see you next episode.
Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn. The stuff that dreams are made of.
I love the smell of napalm in the morning.
Go ahead. Make my day.
You talking to me?